Okay, this is review of the course on Shmuel Aleph, part 2. Okay, that is the course that we've been conducting over the fall semester, 2018. What a wonderful number. 3 years ahead of Back to the Future, which was 2015. That's pretty incredible. There you go. Okay. And we're now future to the back, I suppose, is the other way to describe it. I don't know what we are at the moment. The review lesson usually goes in two stages. Stage number one is just the general instructions about the exam. Right? I apologize, you were in my last lesson. You'll just have to take a little snooze while I go over it again. Leah, probably you heard this already, so maybe you'll hear it again. The second part will just go through very quickly the review sheet that I sent you, looking at some of the points, just to sort of make it clear what type of things I am looking for in terms of the exam. So, in general, again, we spoke about this, but I need to go over it as systematically as I can. Firstly, the exam is 6 questions, of which you have to do 5. Right? There is no extra credits or anything like that. As far as I'm concerned, do your 5, and then you disappear. Okay, you go off and do your thing. I would say to you, because you are towards the end of the exam period, right? Don't schedule any trips, sort of too early before the end of the exam. Meaning, the story I always tell of the young lady who did her scheduling to fly out of JFK. 5 o'clock in the evening when the exam ended at 3. As I said to my other class, I think she was very hooked on Star Trek because she believed that she could beam from here to JFK in a matter of seconds. It wasn't going to happen like that. It would have taken about an hour and a half to get to JFK minimum. What happened was she said, I'm going to get that plane, and she did the exam in 20 minutes. Got a D. Right? Not a great story for her sake, because she compromised her whole... And she was an A student. It was just so annoying and frustrating. I always tell the story because I wanted to make a point that, you know, just plan your life, that when the exam is over, give yourself enough time to finish it. And if you're going to run away and fly into the blue yonder, give yourself enough time to finish the exam first.
Also, if you're trying to get to an airport, don't give yourself only 2 hours.
Don't give yourself 2 hours because you've got to check in. She had to be at the airport at 3. I mean, that was the deal.
She's supposed to be there for like
I mean, she should have been there at 2. So she left here at 1:20. That was also cutting it, but at least she probably would have made the plane. But unbelievable. Sorry?
It's like hearing the story, just like it makes my stomach turn.
It does have a certain sadness to it, but I would say now, I suppose she's... Hi there, welcome back. I guess she's forgotten it many moons ago because she's probably grandmother by now. But it did happen about 20 years ago. Believe it or not. Maybe not a grandmother, but maybe very close. Let me just give this to Liel. Yeah, I just want to give you your paper back. I know it's... Oh, let's have a look at what I wrote. We need to talk about that. We'll if necessary, we can email and discuss it, because Ish Marshall Ladabet. How was South Africa? Was it good? It was good. Excellent. Good. Welcome back. What we're going to do today, again, 2 things. We're going to talk a bit about exam technique or whatever I'm wanting from you, and then we'll go through the list of topics. So, 5 out of 6 questions, no heroics, finish 5 questions, don't do the 6th question and expect extra credit. It's not going to happen. All you'll get from me, even though you won't see the paper, is a red line through question number 6. It's going to be as simple as that. If you want to do them in any order, 6, 5, 4, 3, 1, 2, and whatever, you're allowed to do so. I have no problem with that. You can do them out of order. And also, please, when you use those rather unpleasant blue books, use the pages in the book, not the covers. Cover is just for writing your name, and book number 1, book number 2, but not to write answers. If you want to write messages on the cover, fine, that's no problem, but answers should be on the white pages inside the book. And again, I talk about a young lady who's now not so young anymore, who did a question and answer for me. Don't remember her name, but I remember the answer, because it started on the back cover inside and finished with 1 millimeter to spare on the back cover on the outside. I should have framed it. It was so brilliant. But it just was not the way to answer the question. It was not a good thing to do.
Are you able to ask, we have multiple books if we need.
Oh, exactly. Even if it's one word, I'm telling you, one word to finish, take another book.
For one word? No.
Yeah, for one word.
Read the last three,
yeah, whatever. So, you know, so you write a few words. I mean, it doesn't matter because the whole idea is really just to make the presentation as good as it possibly can be. All right? In terms of pencils, etc., you want to write in pen, pencil, but I always mention about the, I've said this now twice today, the psychedelic colors, leave those at home. Right? I did get an exam in bright pink once, which I really, not making this up, could not read except under sort of glass, you know, under a room where all the curtains were drawn, literally under the blankets at night time, because I couldn't see it any other way. It's a strange ink that this young lady had used.
I hope I get into your like book of stories.
Oh, good. These are real things. It's not. I don't. None of this is made up. It's absolutely for real. It really is for real. They're all on. You can hear my lessons from previous years. They get repeated, but I have to say them because, you know, it just gives you a bit of a guideline. What to do and what not to do. Okay, so again, make sure you have a spare, keep a spare pen, a spare everything. Right? When I was a rabbi, I was told keep everything in the car, spare ketubah when you're doing a wedding, spare handkerchief because, you know, you have to do kinyan, all that sort of thing. Have everything spare. Spare pen. How many rabbis run out of pen? The pen runs out and then you're in the middle of a preparation of a wedding. It can be very embarrassing. So I was given very good advice. Always have a spare. In terms of books to bring to the test, I cannot allow the Judaica that we've been using, but I would say to you, anything Hebrew, English, straight translation, meaning can be a JPS, can be a Koran, can be even the Art Scroll, the big green book, don't have a problem with that, right? But not anything with commentary. I know the Art Scroll has a little bit of commentary there, but we need to... understand that's not a problem. The R scroll with main commentary, not accepted. Okay, anything which is more than the basic commentary explaining the sort of the English words or whatever is not good. But Hebrew English, if you want to underline, you want to highlight in your copy, then I don't have a problem. You may want to bring certain text into the final. You can highlight it before the final, bring that book into the room. I do not have a problem with that.
What?
Or a Chumisra, or a Mikra'a Gedolah, totally in Hebrew. Also allowed. We covered 16 through 31. 16 through 31. I'll just, as we go through the review sheet, I'll just give you the prakim that these subjects cover. Yes?
Will we need the English, Hebrew?
No, I've asked this question already, answered it a number of times today. I highly recommend it.
Okay.
So I'm saying it's a good idea. There may be certain phrases that, nafsho kushurab nafsho. I mean, you can't even do that in English. His soul was bound with his soul. It's much more beautiful in a fine, if you can put it in. If you put it in English, it's not a problem. But if you can put it in Hebrew, how much the better. So just a little phrase like that already, and if you've got a question about David and Yonatan, wow, you know, to add that phrase, it sort of explains a lot. So you see what I'm saying, like little snippet. I'm not looking for big chunks of text, but to have that available would be very advisable. Okay, I'm going to leave it at that. Yes? Yes, Mikra'a Gedolah, Hebrew only, yes. That is acceptable, and if that works for you. For many girls it does, for many it doesn't. So, you know, I give you all the options of what you can and cannot do. In terms of timing, it usually, most people finish within an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and a half. Some of you have extra time, in which case, obviously, that arrangement will be honored. Whenever the exam finishes, probably at 3. If you have like 5 minutes to go, that's fine. If you have a longer need of time, we'll take you down to the room downstairs, 619, I think it is, where extra time will be played. A bit like a metaphor, a sport metaphor, but that's what's going on down there. A bit of extra time. Okay? Yes, Gabrielle.
I was just trying to double check everything.
Yeah, yeah. No, the actual final, again, I don't know where it's going to be. Perfectly honest, I'm not sure. When you come in, you'll have that big yellow paper that tells you where it is. I don't know whether they've decided where all the final. My
I think they're usually in the same
room. It usually would be in here, and don't think that's going to be any different, but I know one of my finals is likely to be in the coach, you know, the auditorium over there. But I don't think it's this group. I think it's another group.
Is that one?
Sorry?
Is that one?
This 1 till 3. So again, if you have any clashes, any other exams that you're doing on the same day, for whatever reason, please, now is the time. Speak to Dr. Katz before it's too late. Otherwise, you may have a big problem. Okay, so don't get yourself into those complications. They are manageable if you prepare in advance. Check your schedules. What else? I think that's about it. Again, want to use one side of the page or both sides of the page to answer questions, up to you, but stick to the white paper, if we're going to say. If I ideally stick to the margins, you know, make it as presentable, as readable as you can. Yes. Again, really, that's your decision, not mine. In other words, if you get a question like here, the whole Goliath story, right? You know, write about, as I've called it here, Star Wars, right? They obviously, what you'll need to tell me is why I am so bothered by the whole story, and obviously you'll need to have to tell me the mechanics of Goliath, what he did, and David, what he does. It's one-on-one. So you've got to have that knowledge enough to make the whole answer meaningful. If you don't mention that in an answer, but you just go on about, you know, the spiritual dimension of the whole thing without explaining the event, it's not going to be a full answer. So that's what I'm saying. So that a certain basic knowledge of the, I suppose the word you would use in Hebrew is pshat, of what's going on. Okay, but more than that is really depending on the review sheet, what I'm asking of you. Right, I'm not expecting you to remember all the arguments that we had in depth, but you know, it'd be nice if some of that stuff came in to your answer as well. Okay. Any other questions? Otherwise, we're moving on. Okay. Right, now, let's see how we get on with the review. Number one. 1 second, something else I was going to mention. Oh, man. Ugh, too tired. All right, it may come to me. So the basic nitty-gritty, again, don't hesitate. Please don't hesitate to email me, Reb Shaffer, AOL. Any questions you may have, I try to answer those questions. Ideally, you'll get a reply within 24 hours. If you don't get a reply, let's say within 48 hours, then please make contact. Hi there. Try and make contact again. If necessary, you can send me stuff on YUEDU as well. Right? iShaffer YUEDU. But I don't like giving that address because I don't really check that email very often. But if you find that you haven't got a response from me, maybe that the email didn't go through. It happens, right? So I want to make sure that the email happens. If necessary, there's an alternative email, which is actually online. My YUEDU address is online if you need to use it. All right, any other questions that you may have? Anything that comes to mind? Otherwise, we will hit the paper. Let's go for the review. Number one, the white lion, the appointment, and the anointment of David. Okay, so what is the white lion? The whole story of Shmuel being told by God, chapter 16. So number one is all about chapter 16, right? The whole situation of Shmuel being told by God to go and anoint David. So what's Shmuel's concern? Very, very simple worry. Shaul is a bit unpredictable at the moment. He's going through what we are calling some sort of depression. What could happen? God forbid. What will Shaul do if he hears Shmuel is going to anoint David? Shaul may do something very bad. What is he going to do to Shmuel? Possibly.
Kill him.
He's worried that Shaul will kill him. Right? And this is very sad because look at this beautiful relationship that they've had all the way through. Saul was the student par excellence of Shmuel. And now we got to the stage where Shmuel is afraid that Shaul, King Saul, will kill him. How terrible the whole story is.
So Hashem goes to Shmuel, right?
So Hashem speaks to Shmuel.
And
tells him to go to anoint David. Correct. And of course, what happens is that Shmuel says, but what happens if Shaul catches me? So Hashem says to him, have no worries, have no fears. I will tell you what to say, tell you what to do. You're bringing a korban. You're bringing a sacrifice to Beit Lechem. All right? You're doing some sort of korban at that time. And that's what you're allowed to say. You'll say that to Shaul, and he will accept it. you're walking with the lamb, you're going to do this sacrifice of family, offering some sort of family celebration, and that will be the response that you can give to the king. So of course, everybody asks the obvious question, what about the truth of the whole story? If Hashem is telling Shmuel to tell something which is not true, he's being, let's use the word, economical with the truth, is this acceptable or not? So we get into a whole discussion. If you look on YU Torah this week, I wrote about this because it comes up in this week's parasha, right? The brothers say to Yosef when they buried their father, they're worried that Yosef will now take revenge, right? And he's got every justification. The way they behaved towards him was pretty horrible. So with sort of going for the basic interpretation. So what do the brothers do? They invent a conversation. They say to Yosef, well, let us inform you of a discussion that we had with Yaakov before he died, where he told us that this is what's going to happen. In other words, don't kill us because we've already, you know, sort of bringing you this message from Yaakov. And they never had that conversation, ever. So Rashi says, Mibnei Darchei Sholem. They were economical with the truth, basically told a white lie, because of Sholem, peace. They didn't want to have the brothers put into a situation where they felt that they might, right, might enable them to attack Yosef. So, go figure. This is again another situation where the truth is being compromised. Okay, so we have to make a distinction between what we call a white lie and a gross lie, right? Sheker, Devar Sheker. It says in the Torah, keep away from Devar Sheker, from a matter of Sheker, of lies. But in the case of a white lie, which is clearly for a purpose, saving lives or whatever it may be, telling the color that she is beautiful, even when she's not, or when she may not necessarily be agreed upon as being the most beautiful woman in the room, say the rabbis, but she is to the chosen, always. And that's the reason why you can say the color is always na'er v'chasuda. Whole discussion in the Gemara about it. So again, the rabbis say, Beit Shammai say, but it's not telling the truth. Right? Beit Shammai didn't get invited to many weddings, I can assure you. Because he would come out and say exactly, you know, you should have said no to the dress, not yes to the dress. That's really what should... without getting into that discussion. That's what Beit Shammai were saying the whole time. So they were pretty tough. Beit Hillel said, Kalanoi v'chasuda, because every bride is beautiful and modest, etc. Because that's the Jewish woman, that's the Jewish bride. Certainly in the eyes of one man in the room. Doesn't have to be in anybody else's opinion, but in the opinion of the Chatan. And that's a beautiful thing, nice idea to say it at a wedding. Again, economical with the truth, the white lie, allowed under certain conditions, diplomatic necessity. Okay, and this is again something which I think we understand from our common sense. There are certain times when we need to be honest, and certain times when we need to be, not dishonest, God forbid, but be economical with the truth, not to say the whole truth and nothing but the truth. You're not in court. I always felt that living in Israel, as I did for 8 years, one of the challenges was that it's a different mindset. In Israel, there's a mindset, at least there used to be, and probably still true, of telling exactly what you think all the time. And it's very hard to live in a place where everyone's telling you what they think the whole time. Right? You know, sometimes it's easier just to know that even if you know they're not enamored or excited about what you're doing, they won't tell you to your face. They may say behind your back, but that doesn't affect you. But when it's to your face the whole time, kind of complicated. Can be difficult to live in that circumstance, and that's a challenge. That's a real challenge. So what we're saying here, in terms of the white lie, is that in this case, we can argue for the sake of peace. Mibnei Darkei Shalom, Shmuel is allowed to say, make up the story, and who is giving him permission to do this? None other than the good Lord himself. Hashem is telling Shmuel what to do. So that's a whole discussion about it. Please look at the handout because I think it's really... The whole thing is really quite impressive. You know, the idea, the message of this. We need to understand about diplomacy and tact. Really important lesson. Number two. Any questions on that before we go on? Number two.
Wait, what was the phrase in Hebrew of lying for peace?
Yeah, Mibnei Darkei Shalom. To do it for the sake of peace. Darkei Shalom. So it's Rashi brings it actually on this week's parasha. Chapter 50. I can tell you where it is because I've just written about it. Chapter 50 in Bereshit. Verse 16 and 17. You'll see over there, if you look at those verses, Rashi brings it. And this is a classic example. There's a whole story which I've written about there with the Chamalivitz. I was in a shir when she actually mentioned this. I asked her a question and she scared the life out of me, because she was 92 years old at the time. Very frail, very sharp, very brilliant, but very frail. And she got up, middle of the shir, she stopped the shir. For 10 minutes she disappeared. She comes back with a piece of paper which was yellow. It had been typed in 1946 or something. And it had every question that I just asked. It was all on the page. So she spent the rest of the evening going through this page. It was quite unbelievable. You know, my mouth dropped. I just couldn't believe it. I said, Nechama, where did you get this from? She said, on the Mipeset, that she had piles and piles of different dapim, pages of notes of different things on Torah, Tanakh. Unbelievable lady. Fabulous woman. Yes. No, again, not really. I'm looking for the gists, for the message, for the general idea. All right, if you can be more specific, kol hakavod. But that's not what I. You know, if this was an MA course, it would be a different answer. The answer there would be yes, absolutely. Here, no. All right, number two, the Goliath episode, Star Wars of a Spiritual Nature. Again, as I said, the basic question. This is chapter 17, beginning. What is going on with Goliath's challenge to the Jewish people? Send out one person and we'll have one-on-one. Right? And remember, we saw Rebachra, who again is a name that I hope now you're aware of. Great writer, of someone who passed away about 20 years ago in Israel. Is it 20 years or 30 years? 1996. Yeah, 20 years ago. 20, just over 22 years. Six. So it's around that time that you guys came into this world. He unfortunately left the world. Very, very special teacher. Again, one of the great unknown teachers in Israel, unless you actually had the privilege to study with him. Very special man. So he writes about this and written about a lot of things that we've been learning this semester. And he says basically that the whole one-on-one thing was, again, to understand what I think what he's trying to say is that this was not a regular occurrence. This was Goliath coming to Am Yisrael with a weapon which he thought would defeat them. And it wasn't going to be his sword, but it was going to be his undermining the spirituality of the Jewish people. He stopped them saying Kriyat Shema. He did this for 40 days. Number 40 is not by chance. All to do with 40 days of going up the mountain. Well, we know the connections. And Goliath was also aware of these connections. He comes from Orpah. Okay, his grand, great, whatever, grandmother was the woman who left Ruth, the two sisters. Ruth goes with Naomi to become Jewish. Orpah goes back to become Moabite, to return to her people. And Goliath is the product of that particular return. So he has, in his knowledge base, he knows where the Jews are coming from, because he knows from his, you know, his bubi, from whatever she was, Alta bubi. Okay, what exactly all that was all about. So the reality of it is, Goliath is attacking Am Yisrael in a spiritual way. It is more the forces of good versus the forces of evil. The problem is that for Shaul, he doesn't understand this maybe the way he should have done, and he is petrified. Okay, this is all beginning of chapter 17. Shaul is immobilized. He can't move. He is so fearful of what Goliath represents physically. And Shaul is a big guy. He's 6'8", 6'9", who knows how tall he really is. Goliath is obviously much taller, much bigger, but Shaul is unable to overcome his fear, his tremendous sense of how am I ever going to stand up, represent the Jewish people fighting this brute. Okay, along comes David and the whole situation changes. So again, the whole idea that the war that was being suggested over here was not necessarily a physical challenge, the war was much more conducted on a spiritual basis. And Goliath understood it and was so, again, as we explained in the Psukim, everything about him is materialistic. Describes his uniform, his helmet, his spear. Because that is Goliath. Goliath is a man of Olam Hazeh, this world. David comes along and represents Olam Haba. David represents the power of Kedusha. No real weapon. He's got a few stones and a sling. Big deal. He's fighting a guy with a sword which is like 10 foot long. Unbelievable. Okay, and nevertheless, David says, not worried, if God wants me to win, we'll win this. Okay, the incredible emunah.
David fights Goliath essentially with his faith, with his connection to God. It's really a different type of war.
Okay.
To a lesser extent, there was clearly a very physical war as well. Wasn't just a.
Oh, didn't they take away all the men's spot that made them?
Correct. The whole thing that the Ivanim wanted to do was to Hellenize, meaning to take the Judaism away from the Jews, which is a spiritual war.
It's like a parallel story.
It can be understood as a parallel. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but there are different facts, but the sort of concept is very similar. Correct. It's good. Any comments? Yes, please.
You said that Esau from saying Shema for 40 days. Mm. Can you please remind me of that?
Yeah, Rashi brings it in chapter 17. It's around Pasuk 12 or 13. You'll see the Rashi there. Okay, and he says that Goliath would come along. It says in the morning, in the evening. So Rashi says, why in the morning, in the evening? Because he knew that's the time when the Jews wanted to dump. And he started his screaming and cursing and all the rest of it in order to disturb the tefillah, all right?
It's like he scared them and like bothered them, or
he on purpose.
I don't know, they couldn't concentrate because he was shouting.
He was shouting abuses at God. I mean, it was awful. And you know, earplugs had not been invented yet, so I guess they just had to stand and listen, and they couldn't daven. Yeah, it's pretty terrible. All right, that's number two. Number three, Eitzah Mukah and its implications. Right, again, we had this in the parsha a few weeks ago, that. It says when Yaakov sent Yosef, this is, by the way, number 3 is also chapter 17, verse 18, Pasuk Yudchet, all right? And the same thing for number 4, 3 and 4, more or less around the same Pasukim. Chapter 17, Pasuk Yud, actually goes back a little bit further than that. So I think it's 14 to 18, if I'm being more precise. Eitzah Mukah is really chapter 17, Pasuk Yud Dalet, 14. Number 4, Rubatam, is Yud Zayin, chapter 17, verse 18. Arubatam, that I know for sure. So that's the source reference for number 3 and number 4, all in chapter 17. So what's Eitzah Mukah? Very simple. We have the question of questions: why did Yishai agree to send David to the front line? Doesn't make sense. David is not necessarily, right? He certainly wasn't included in the army of Shaul, even though already he'd been playing music for Shaul, but he wasn't in a fighting capacity, even though he was much more of a warrior than maybe Shaul really understood. And at this point, he's being sent by Yishai to the front line. So we said, let's compare it to the story of Yaakov sending Yosef to the brothers that we read about a few weeks ago. Surely Yaakov knew that the brothers hated Yosef for everything that he had said, all the dreams, etc. And as a consequence of their hatred, they did not behave in any sort of friendly way to Yosef. So why is Yaakov sending him to the brothers to find out where they are, whatever, they're in Shechem, not in Shechem, Dothan, etc. That whole story doesn't make sense. And the answer to both of them is a pasuk actually in the story of Yosef, which says that he was sent from Emek Chevron, from the valley of Chevron. So the rabbis say, what do you mean the valley of Chevron? Chevron's up a hill. It's very high up there. Okay, it's in the clouds sometimes, Chevron. So the answer is that he sent him not from the valley geographically, but Emek Chevron means Eitzah Amukah. It was a very deep-seated plan of God. What does it mean? That God made it that just as Yosef had to go to the brothers to begin the process of going down to Mitzrayim because he'd be sold and he'd end up in Mitzrayim, you know, prepare the way for the family to come there. So the same thing over here, that David had to go to the front line to become the king of Israel. If David had not established his credentials with Goliath, then it would have been much tougher for him to be accepted eventually as the king of Israel. So it's Eitzah Amukah, the whole idea that this is really God's plan, right? Deep Eitzah, deep advice. Okay, so I hope that's sort of clear. Any questions? Sorry.
What did you say?
Emek Hebron. It says that in the story of Yaakov sending Yosef, and again it's chapter 37 of Bereishit. Don't know which pasuk, but you can look it up there, you'll find the pasuk. Sort of in the middle, around about, I don't know, verse 15, something like that. Eitzah Amukah. And this again is the comparison that Rav Bachrach makes, and I think it's a beautiful comparison. Chapter 37, Pasuk, right about 15, in Breishit. Okay, that's where Eitz HaMukar is found. Number four, Aruba Tam. We had a big problem with what David was taking to the brothers, right? Remind me some of the interpretations. Aruba Tam, the initial translation is to find out how they are, how they're doing, how they're getting on. But say the Mephoreshim, that's a bit more than that, right? What did David take to the brothers? Yes.
Forgets.
Yeah. Okay. It was stuff to do with the war. There's also, even more extreme than that, what was the law which was established when people went to war, in case they didn't come back?
The pre-war law.
Get. Yeah, the get, right? Did you say get?
You said get.
I didn't hear the word get. All right, so that's it. The bills of divorce. Excellent. The whole idea to take bills of divorce to the brothers to make sure that these are filled out, sign on the dotted line, because they may not come back from war, and chas v'shalom, their wives might remain agunot, which was to be avoided. A bit like the prenuptial of the 21st century in its own way. Another suggestion is, obviously he took food. What's the most extreme suggestion? Look through your notes, you'll see all the different suggestions. The most beautiful suggestion, I think, is the one which, again, Rabbi Bachrach makes, which is to do with the idea of guarantee. Who is going to be a guarantor for whom? Okay, what's the biblical story that we are relating to? We just read it last week, Parsha Vayigash. Who stands up for Binyamin? None other than Yehuda. Vayigash Elav Yehuda. He goes to Yosef and he says, you know, basically, I'm here and don't mess around. Right? Don't play us around anymore. And that's when Yosef says, I can't hold back. He cries his eyes out. Very interesting character, Yosef, but think about it. Very, very interesting person. Lived in Egypt. I had a lot to say about him, but not for now. Yes. Yeah, we'll just come to that. We saw last week in the Parsha, Yehuda looks after Binyamin, stands up for Binyamin. David is going to the front line. He represents Yehuda. And who is he coming to defend? Shaul. Who is Shaul? From the tribe of Binyamin. All right? There is historical precedent. Arubatam, there's like, we call it a historical guarantee. David becomes the guarantor of the success of Yehuda as Shaul, as he is representing the tribe of Binyamin. And where does this precedent come from? From the story of Yehuda Binyamin, which we read in Parshat Vayigash. And therefore, Arubatam means guarantee, Arev. Ayin Reshbet means to guarantee. What's a guarantee? That if you borrow money from your friend, I come along and say, if she doesn't pay you back, I will pay you instead. You take upon yourself the loan, the responsibility. So in this case, what's going on? Yehuda is taking the responsibility of looking after Binyamin. David is being sent to the front line. Maybe he doesn't realize it, but he is continuing that biblical precedent of being responsible for Binyamin. How is he showing it? By being, in this case, responsible for Shaul. All right. Any questions about that? Because that's really special. Look at the note, because there are other items. I don't remember now in the whole list of Aruba Tam, but this idea of the historical guarantee, I think, is a fabulous idea. It's an idea which we have in the Torah very often. Maaseh Avot, Siman Labanim. What happens to the Avot is a guide to what will happen to later generations. Right. Very beautiful concept, right through Sefer Bereishit. Any comments? Any questions? Otherwise, we're moving on. Running out of time. Not doing too bad, actually. Yes, question? No, you're just having a stretch. Good. Okay, number five. The uniform of Shaul. What was so special about this whole event? The symbolism of clothing in the Sefer. Alright, so we find clothing as being affected. In what sense? What happens to various cloaks, particularly of Shaul? They are... Well, that's the uniform, but before we get to that, what's the whole thing with the cloak, which David does a number of times, right? Or rather, in this case, Shaul does it to Shmuel. He rips the corner of the cloak. And of course, that symbolically is something which is a sign of being torn away from your future situation. You should remain as king, but you're not going to remain there. That's what happened to Shaul. David, in fact, does the same thing when he almost is in a position to kill Shaul, round about chapter 24. He cuts the cloak of the king to prove that he could have killed him. Say the rabbis, but this was disrespectful to King Shaul. And as a consequence, David is cold in his old age. Beginning of the book of Kings. David is cold to the point where he can't warm himself up. And say, the Pasuk says he's looking for a young lady to come and be a bit of a warmer. Keep him nice and warm. Okay, if that's what it means, different interpretations. The whole question of the uniform, as you say, Sarah, very correctly, is to do with the fact that the incredible lesson that we learn about David, that the whole idea of David wearing the king's uniform, the king is horrified. David wants to go and fight Goliath, and he hasn't even got a sword. Certainly hasn't got armor. So the king says, wait a minute, put on my armor. So of course, David looks at the king and says, yeah, you're 6'9", and I'm 5'2". This is not going to work. Not a good idea. So David tries it on, and miraculously, the armor fits David. So David's got a dilemma. Does he go out facing Goliath wearing the armor, right, or not? And what's his dilemma? That the king would be absolutely, I think, that, let's put it very bluntly, the king's going to be very embarrassed, but more than that, the king will be mortified. Because he will see that the armor miraculously fits David is obviously a sign of David being in the good books of the Lord, right? David is with God, whereas Shaul seems to be rejected. It will add to Shaul's depression in a way which is really, really serious. So as a consequence of not wanting to go in that particular derech, that particular way, the uniform was taken off by David. David said, right, there's a whole pasuk there, again, chapter 17, round about verse 40, where it says there quite clearly that David decides, I'm not going to wear your uniform, because I know that this will cause you more grief if I do wear it than if I don't. And Shaul now really begins to see what a tzaddik David is. He's prepared to go and fight the most ominous, awesome enemy of the Jewish people, who is so physical in everything he represents. And David's going out there literally with a sling, a couple of stones in his pocket, and a tremendous amount of faith, emunah, and that's it. And it's pretty scary. Okay, so that's the whole thing with the uniform teaches us. David's sensitivity towards Shaul, that I think is really special. How amazing is David HaMelech? How amazing. Come along to Shmuel Bet next semester. You'll like it. But it's the late lesson. That's the problem. So you may be dunking.
Yeah, but it's almost over the season.
It's almost over. Okay, so not
Before
too bad.
Be there.
Not too bad. All right. Because it's fabulous. Shmuel Bet is really like the focus of David HaMelech. Incredible. Shaul's question. This is all chapter 17 still, number 6. Shaul's strange question, end of chapter 17, who is the lad? That's right at the end of chapter 17, round about Pasuk Nun Hey. Right? We're up to number 6 on the page. Who is the lad? And of course, the question is, of course, he knows who David is. So he's talking to Avner, Uncle Abner. Uncle Abner is the head of the army and Shaul's uncle. And Shaul is saying to Uncle Abner, find out who this lad is. And it's very strange because David's been playing music for him for who knows how long. A couple of months, maybe even a couple of years. Right? To try and build him up a bit. So it's a very strange question. So obviously it's not about who he is in the sense of his name and rank and title. But find out who he really is. Find out who he's descended from, his yichus. Find out if he's from the tribe of Yehuda. See if he comes from the line which is the line of kingship. Right, there were two twins born to Yehuda from Tamar, Peretz, okay, and
Zerah.
And Zerah, correct. And the line of Peretz is the line of kings. Line of Zerah is not the line of kings. So find out, does David come from the line of Peretz? Of course he does. So the reality is that Shaul is really asking at the end of chapter 17, not who is David, but he's asking who is David. All right, who is he for real? Who is he for real? What is he all about? That's the end of chapter 17, and we did a whole page on that, and it's really a special discussion. Number 7 is chapter 18, which is the love of David and Jonathan, without going into all of the stereotyping that we try to avoid. The reality of it is a spiritual approach. We said in the end of the day, that's David and Jonathan chapter 18.
Okay.
Okay? All the rest of them are up to, through number 6 on the page was all chapter 70, except the first item. 60. So we're now on to chapter 18. The love of David and Jonathan, Nafsho, Keshurab and Nafsho. Are you leaving us? I have to say au revoir, or lehitraot, which is a better thing to say. Have a good one. Shabbat shalom. All right, you're doing 2 of my exams. Good luck. All right, see you there. The love of David and Jonathan, David and Yonatan. What a fabulous story. All right? So a spiritual approach. What do I mean by that? Many people have taken it as in the most basic and unfortunately very, as we say, bringing things down to brass tacks, taking things and lowering them to the lowest possible level, which unfortunately is not what we're supposed to do. Certainly not as believing Jews. We're supposed to elevate and not relegate. And in this case, David and Jonathan represent this incredible, the word in Hebrew is she'ifa. She'ifa means this desire to make things even more intense than they were they're fighting with each other over becoming more spiritual. The question about David and Jonathan is a very simple question. How could Jonathan be so much a friend of someone who is really should be his enemy number one? Yonatan represents the continuation of the kingship. David represents the challenge to the kingship. So how can David and Jonathan be friends? Right? It's literally two princes who should be, you know, sort of like Romeo and Juliet, you know, sort of the two houses there, fighting each other. And in this case, this is quite the opposite. So we said that it's not about physical friendship that we're really talking about, though that's part of it. It's much more the spiritual approach. They are both men of very high spiritual aspiration. And in fact, Yonatan seems to be more spiritually aspired than David, because Yonatan makes the compromise and continues with the friendship of David, even though he knows that by doing so, he is essentially blocking his own future. David will become the king and Yonatan will not. But they are both men who understand getting closer to God is what it's all about. And in that beautiful story, when they take their leave of each other, which is in fact chapter 20, this incredible speech that goes between them, this idea, may God be with you, between you and me forever and ever. Clearly their relationship is a very godly relationship. Right? Just by the language of what they say to each other, the way that they talk to each other. It's really very, very beautiful. So look again at that particular story. We read it, it's the Haftarah, when we have Rosh Chodesh on a Sunday. We always read that on the Shabbat before Rosh Chodesh because it's called Machar Chodesh. The pasuk there begins in the middle of the chapter with the words, tomorrow is Rosh Chodesh. So the rabbis say, we always read that as a Haftarah, when tomorrow, meaning Sunday, is Rosh Chodesh. Okay, so it's read once or twice a year as a Haftarah. So that's the love of David and Jonathan. Any comments? I think we can move on, I hope. Number 8, the place of Doeg, his antipathy to David, the issue of David's yichus. So this is always going to be a big question. David comes from Ruth. Ruth, by definition, is excluded, should be, from the Jewish people, because she comes from Moab. And the pasuk says in the Torah that Moavi is not, essentially Moabites are not allowed to convert to become Jewish. All right, goes back to the whole story at the beginning with Lot. It's a pagam. They're very blemished with that whole story. So the problem is, what about the story here of David's yichus? And we have to say that on a number of occasions in history, the matter was discussed. First time with Boaz, right at the beginning when he marries Ruth, and his bet din made an analysis of the Torah, Moavi velo Moavit. Who's forbidden to become Jewish? The man, not the woman. So Ruth, by definition of that analysis, is acceptable in the Jewish people. Along comes Shmuel later on and confirms the same decision. Along comes Doeg, right, a few years later, and questions the whole thing all over again. And Rav Bachrach brings, if you remember, a whole discussion from the Gemara, where one of the gentlemen of the day, who was a member of the army, brings a sword into the Beit Midrash, and he plunks the sword, boom, in front of everybody, and he says that there's no question that David is Jewish, and anyone who disagrees with that decision will have to deal with the sharpness of my sword. In other words, I'm prepared to kill over this. Right? This is a guy in the story that I think he's called Amasa Ben Yeta. Amasa says that he's one of the captains of the army. When we do Shmuel Bet, he comes up in the story in Shmuel Bet. Okay, I'm plugging Shmuel Bet at the moment, but it's such a great book. Yeah. It's again where that all takes place. Doeg is essentially more in chapter 21, 22. Story of Nov. Alright, so number 8. I'm sorry, should I mention that? Number 8, we're moving into chapters 21 and 22. What happens is... Sorry?
Skip 19 and 20.
Yeah, 19 and 20. We didn't really go into. If you remember, you read them. We said a little bit about 19 because David meets up with Shmuel only once. And Chazal say that they met to discuss the future building of the Beit HaMikdash. Quite amazing. And they spent the whole night talking about it. So David was not a slouch. When he needed to, he would pull an all-nighter quite easily. He probably pulled many all-nighters because he was running around chasing enemies all over the place. The place of Doeg is very challenging because Doeg is a great scholar, but he's also, unfortunately, not a very nice person. Let's put it very, very diplomatically. The story of Doeg is very extreme because when the town of Nob is accused by Shaul of harboring David, who was considered a rebel, the punishment, said the king, was death. You harbored a rebel of the king, you're liable for the death sentence. And Saul is trying to get someone to carry it out. Who in the end carries out the death sentence? Doeg. Not a very nice person. Okay? You leave it to the executioner. If he doesn't want to do it, maybe the king should have done it himself. But Doeg, volunteering to kill 85 kohanim, it's terrible. Terrible story. And of course, the whole question we have to ask about Doeg is, you know, what is he really all about? He's a man, again, who seems to have spiritual aspirations, but one also gets the feeling he also has other ambitions as well. All right, he's an army man, he's a man of the book, but he's also a man of the army. He seems to be someone who always is in contrast to David. Right? Doeg is the one who sort of brings it to the king's attention, the faults that David has. Doeg seems to have it in for David. Permanent. I suppose you would say he is the nemesis of Yonatan. Much as Yonatan is close to David, Doeg is quite the opposite. Alright, so he, maybe you can look at it like that. Number 9, Shaul's illness, the approach of Abakra. This is again an overview, so this goes right from chapter 18 through till sort of 27 essentially, right, where we see all the examples of Shaul's illness. Rabakra says, can we call it madness? And he says, no, because they are still following him. Even though you're claiming he's mad, people will not be following him. Can we say that this is a classic case of tragedy as per the Greek definition of it? You know, fate has made this happen. The answer is, of course, no. That's not a Jewish concept. So says Rabakra, the bottom line of Shaul's illness is a spiritual loss. Shaul knows what he had, that high of connection to God before the story of Amalek, and that was transferred to David. And Shaul feels it. It's like experiencing the most incredible, incredible spiritual moment, and then it goes away. I was listening to the radio this morning, somebody from Los Angeles who was a Baalat Tshuva. She was an actress in Hollywood, became religious. And the thing she said that really affected her was when she went to the Kotel for the first time. She said she went home after going to the Kotel and she cried. Right? Amazing. Said something happened. There was a connection there with her roots, with her Jewishness, which she never thought existed. And she became observant. She lives in LA and she's married now. She's from. Quite an amazing story. Interesting story. So again, all of what we're saying over here, the whole concept of awareness of spirituality, or in Shaul's case, loss of spirituality. And that's what made him sick. Bottom line, that's what made him very unwell. He just could not handle what he used to be as opposed to what he had become. So that's sometimes the definition of tragedy as well. Avigail, the quintessential Talmidah Chachama, number 10, is chapter 25. Avigail, you have to just... Also not. We read them very briefly. Stories of Engedi, but, you know, not really in any depth. Okay, 20. Avigail, the quintessential Talmidah Chachamah. Please look at the notes, and if you missed the shiurim, there's certainly what to catch up. It's on YouTorah if you can access it there to listen to what we said. Avigail is, without doubt, probably to me, when you learn the story, I really believe she's the most remarkable woman in the Bible. All right, I know we've got Devorah and we've got the ladies of the Torah. So again, chapter 25 of Avigail, the story when she protects her husband, who is a lowlife, Naval, refuses to help David, and she goes and meets David in the middle of the night when he's racing towards the house of Naval to kill him, because David considers Naval already a rebel. David's treating himself as the king, and Naval is a rebel against the king, so David is applying that rule for himself. And says Avigail, "I'm sorry, David, I can't accept that. Answer me the question." She holds up a red rag, which she claims is dam nida, blood of nida. And she says to David, "Can you tell me whether it is or it isn't?" And David says, "It's nighttime. How can I answer this question? It's dark. Can't see the color." So she says to him, "And you gave a decision about my husband at nighttime? You're not supposed to make decisions at nighttime, period. You're head of a religious court." So David says, "You beat me square, fair and square." All right, credible interaction, according to the Gemara, between David and Avigail. Brucha ta'amech u'brucha at. If you have to write it, that's the pasuk to mention. Around verse 31, 32 of chapter 25. You are blessed, and your reasoning, ta'amech, your taste. Literally your taste, but here it means your reasoning. Your reasoning is baruch, brucha, is blessed. Because you beat me in a discussion about Jewish law. And of course, the whole scenario that the rabbis create there is quite extraordinary. How did she stop David in his tracks, say the rabbis? Because she revealed her thigh. So the rabbis ask a very serious question. What about tzniut over here? What's going on? So Tosfot says there was something kind of, he was mesmerized by her. There was an inner connection, which is represented by the thigh. She didn't actually reveal it, but there was some sort of chum, he says, some sort of heat that went between them. Whatever that is, chemistry. I don't know what sort of chemistry you want to describe it. Right, love at first sight. I don't know how you describe it. But she's still married. The issue is more, we saw that the thigh represents the yesod, the foundation. We saw this Rabbi Ferber. Okay, the commentary that I showed you from a rabbi who used to be in England. And he writes that what the thigh represents is the fundamentals. That she showed David essentially the reasons why what he was doing was wrong, and shared with him some of the fundamental basics of Jewish life, of how to behave as a Jewish leader, and David was overwhelmed by it. Alright, that's what she really did. Again, this is chapter 25, around the psukim. The whole thing with the thighs is Gemara. That's Gemara Megillah. So the actual psukim is, again, the whole discussion begins around verse 20, through verses 33-34. And by the time the whole thing ends, Naval has died. He has a fit. He has a stroke because his wife tells him that she gave all that food away. Can't handle that. He's a very unpleasant gentleman. And at the end of the day, David waits the required amount of time, seemingly, and then goes and marries Avigail. She becomes wife number two. Okay, he's allowed six wives altogether. Or 18, but he actually married six. So a lot to say about Avigail. Please look at your notes. Really special. The Witch of Endor, we said five different interpretations about the Witch of Endor. Again, please look up the notes. Was it for real? Was it not for real? And in the end, what was the explanation of Menashe ben Yisrael, the famous rabbi that we spoke about? He writes about all of the explanations, and he said the bottom line is, it was during the 12 months since Shmuel had died. And he says, during those 12 months, the neshama is not yet completely removed from this world, whatever that means. And therefore, she was able to connect Shaul to Shmuel, right? To the neshama of Shmuel, which was still around. And the scary thing is that once she realizes what's going on, she is absolutely petrified because she realizes it's the king, right? And according to what we've heard from, I think Sarah mentioned this, that the Midrash even suggests that there she's relative, she's related. And all of this is very scary. Okay? And the worst thing about it is that Shaul hears from her that he is going to be killed in battle. Not only him, but his sons. Tragic. Tragedy. Absolute tragedy. Nothing he can say. And of course, number 12, the suicide of Shaul, chapter 31, the last chapter in the book, which the opinions, did he really commit suicide, meaning is he the rule, is he exception to the rule? Okay, we gave you a page on that. And again, what do you think? Because I'm interested to know what you think in the end. Did he commit suicide at that point? Was it a death, an honorable death? You know, if you're the king of Israel, surrounded by all these enemies, and you don't want to be abused, remember we said that. He was in a situation where he did not want the enemy to abuse him, to use him for idolatry, or to take him to the idol, the palace of their idol, whatever it was, the Plishtim. So Shaul decides, better to die a Jew than to be abused and taken to the land of the Plishtim. I guess he was thinking maybe of what happened to Shimshon, because that's what happened to Shimshon. And in the end, Shimshon managed to overcome it, but how he was abused by them was terrible. Terrible. Yes, question.
Sorry, which paragraph is
11? The Witch of Endor is chapter 28. Right? Chapter 28 of the Savior.
26 and 27.
Again, 26. Those are chapters which are much more narrative. Worth reading, but we didn't really go into them. And then finally, chapter 31. So we missed out 20, 29 and 30. That was David basically running around for his life, getting his wives back. You know, it's part of the story. Just worth reading the story, whether you can bring that into a question will be up to you. You know, that sort of information. Yes, please.
Yeah. I
probably, in a question about it, I will probably give you a number. I would say write about three interpretations of the story. Including, and I would always point out, the interpretation of Rabbi, the one that I, you know, sort of is the, to me, that's the one that makes the most sense of a very, let's use the word, difficult story. Right, how do we really ever understand this story? I don't know. I think we're done. In terms of the analysis, I think we very much covered it. Obviously, there may be other stuff which may come up, but this is generally where you need to focus on. I don't know what more to say. Any other questions before I send you on your weary way? Must be weary by now. Just to say, this group, as groups in the past, has been an absolute delight. I've got to tell you, because number one, I get to know who you are. So I now remember you're Gabrielle. I mean, I actually know your name, which is great. You know, it's really, really frustrating for me that in my other groups it's been challenged just to remember who's who. But that, more to the point, that you've had a chance to express yourselves. We've had, Nechama used to say, Nechama Leibowitz, she said the learning should be a chavaya. It's not just a learning, but it should be an experience. A chavaya, a word in Hebrew, very hard to translate. And I think it has been a bit of a chavaya. We've got to know David HaMelech. We've started the process of getting to know someone that we all need to know. As I said to you, you've got to make a little bit of space. If you have a young man who you're set on, a little bit of space in the corner for David, not that anything more than an appreciation and awareness of who he is in your life as a Jew. Because without knowing David, you're missing a whole thing of what it means to be Jewish. He is such a special guy. And with his faults and with his challenges, and of course in Shmuel Bet, we'll come to grips with even more of that stuff. It's beautiful stuff. I want to thank you guys. I learned so much from your essays, particularly how inspiring they were. And just to say good luck with everything that's going on. I hope to see many of you next semester. Rivka's got a final comment.
Yeah. You said that the final will take about an hour and 20 minutes.
No, it's scheduled for 2 hours.
Yeah, but you said it's probably going to...
On average, people finish within an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and 30 minutes, something like that.
Is it going to be more... obviously, it's going to be more detailed than this review session.
Yeah.
But... are the questions going to be a lot more specific or a lot
Yeah, you'll have every question has parts, which you have to answer every part, okay. And we'll be very specific, as much as I can be, in terms of what I'm asking you to write.
So it's going to be 6 questions, and each question is going to have multiple parts.
Yeah, and please do not answer 6, but answer 5.
Yeah. I was wondering how it would take up...
Yeah, it really does, okay? Yeah, it should fill up your time very nicely, I hope. Wish everybody Shabbat Shalom. Thank you for listening. Have a great Shabbos, everybody. Thank you.